Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Recep Tayyip Erdogan is a towering politician. He's dominated Turkey for 20 years and is now being compared to Atatürk as a man who's changed the direction of Turkish society. And that matters not just to Turkey, but to the international community more generally, partly because of Turkey's geostrategic position, but also because he has great influence on the future direction of political Islam. So, what has he done? What does it signify? And where is he headed? Well, Dimitar Betchev has studied the man for his book, Turkey Under Erdogan. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And let's just begin, if we can, with his personal story. What sort of a family was he born into?
Well, he comes from a lower middle class background. His family had moved to Istanbul, one of those areas not far from the downtown, but really sort of on the periphery, and he epitomized this whole generation of people who headed west from their original native cities and villages in the heartland for the pursuit of a better life and life opportunities. His father came from the east of Turkey in the Black Sea region, so he was a man of modest means, but one thing that defined the strata, the group in those urban neighborhoods was conservatism, not just piety, but also as a ethos in social life. And it's something that has been mythologized in various forms, including a biopic that came about a few years back about the young Erdogan, how he grew up in the neighborhood and made it of the social ladder. And those people tend to be very aspirational. Erdogan has, with his life story, but also with his policies, tapped into that, hoping for the better for their children. They'll have a modest education, but they'll certainly be hopeful that their offspring will do better. And in the case of Erdogan, one other aspect that might be is interesting is that he comes from an area which is ethnically mixed. It's very likely that his family is ethnically Georgian. But as Erdogan has stated on more than one occasion, what makes you Turkish ultimately is not ethnicity, but religion. So Sunni Islam is the common denominator, and it's therefore central to Turkish identity in the way that also was the conduit for his family to connect to the Turkish mainstream. So he's in many ways the epitome of the real Turkey, something that he has explored throughout his career. There is the Turkey of Atatürk, of the Kemalist self-entitled elites in the bureaucracy, in the military. And there is the real Turkey, which is at peace with its ethnic diversity, but also very much committed to Islam and traditionalism and open to the modern world, as it were. So his family is where this story starts, pretty much.
Presumably, as he was being brought up in Istanbul then, there would have been many others like him with very similar backgrounds who would have had rather a frustrating life, is that right? Who, you know, had aspirations, but the economy and the political system wasn't really there for them to fulfil those aspirations.
Yes, but we shouldn't overplay this theme of marginalization, which of course the AKP has put forward as its leitmotif, because, I mean, Turkey was hierarchical and sort of elitist in some sense, but also it was always open for people to make it up in social hierarchy. There are several examples before Erdogan of people of modest means who rose to the top. In fact, the political system that Turkey built, of course, very exclusionary with the military and with authoritarian gene, but at the same time defined by relatively free and fair elections, open possibility for this sort of retail slash populist politics, which sought to mobilize people like Erdogan or more broadly the conservative heartland and to bring them into the national political life. So it is ambiguous. I mean, yes, Erdogan had a rough start, but it's not that all channels were closed for him and there were avenues to make it up. And what turned out, just the risk of jumping ahead of myself, such platform, springboard for his career turned out to be the Islamist movement. And so then that was the launch rocket for Erdogan's career.
We will get onto that. Obviously, the whole question of Islam and the role it's played in his career later. But just looking at the whole political career from beginning to today, how successful has he been electorally? Can you just sort of spell that out for us?
Well, tremendously, despite the occasional setbacks and, again, a very unclear future given the critical election next year. But he has prevailed in a succession of electoral races and also referendums. And he has used the ballot box as his instrument to neutralize, subdue his rivals, especially the incumbent elites. And he has used the majoritarian logic of electoral competition to reshape Turkey in his image. The critical point was 2017 with the constitutional referendum, which redesigned the political system and established a presidential regime. So by any count, he has made the most of elections and the electoral process.
And just one other broad point. He is associated in the West mainly with his Islamism. But in terms of Turkish politics, I guess one of the big things of his career has been confronting and getting on top of the military, which, you know, was a massive achievement.
Yes, and it speaks to the fact that Islamism was not a fixed thing. Many opponents of Erdogan, for instance, would point to tactical alliance between the Islamists and Milli Görüş, the National Outlook Movement, Erbakan and the rest, with the military around the time of the 1980 coup, which played a critical role. So back then, Islamists were fellow travelers and the military actually introduced religious education into the school curriculum as a bulwark to what they saw, the threat of communist infiltration. And it's only later in the 90s, and when the relationship between the two players turned sour, and by the time Erdogan arrived on the scene as the mayor of Istanbul and later as prime minister, the battle lines were drawn. But it's just to say that this confrontation went through different stages. And one other thing about Islamism, that it went ideologically through different permutations. The original ideology of Milli Görüş combined sort of commitment to Islam as organizing principle of society with critique of the West, very much in the tune of the third worldism that was fashionable with the leftists at the time. Erbakan opposed NATO, opposed Turkish ambitions to join the EU at the time. What Erdogan did later on was to splinter for this movement and repackage Islam as friendly towards the West. That was post 9/11. He embraced wholeheartedly the EU and capitalism, economic liberalization. And it was a totally different version of political Islamism. And now we're in chapter two, when and it's a long conversation how he got there. But suffice to say that the version of Islamism right now is much more nationalistic and right-wing, open to other factions in the center-right than the Nationalist Action Party, but also anti-Western Eurasianists, who are very critical of the United States and see Turkey as a beleaguered fortress that has to fight for its existence and prosperity in a hostile world. And it's a very different image and version of Islamism. And it's just in the span of his career that he moved from those three stages.
So to summarize all that, he started with a very powerful military. He now has control of the military, and he started with a lot of pro-Western positions, has ended up with many more sort of Islamist nationalist positions.
Absolutely. And he not just overpowered the military and the state, but he took over. So many of the authoritarian reflexes of the Turkish state have remained the same, and the litmus test is the Kurdish issue. But Erdogan co-opted that and actually switched sides. That's why a lot of people that were amongst his fiercest critics in the early days are now amongst his partisans, because in their view that he saw the light, embraced Turkish nationalism and the idea of the strong state. But also what AKP and Erdogan gave to the Turkish state was legitimacy. Before, you could argue that the incumbent elites, nationalistic and statist as they were, didn't have the backing of society at large, a mass political force as the AKP, at least in the old days, because now its support is eroding, injected a sense of cultural authenticity, cultural legitimacy. So the state, heavy-handed as it were, represented the true Turkey. There was a majority of the population behind it. And that's how Erdogan rolled. So he fought the military, he fought the bureaucracy, but at the end of the day, he overpowered them and he co-opted them and gave them place in the new setup.
Yeah, I mean, there must be people in Egypt, in Pakistan, thinking, I wonder if someone could do that here, because, you know, they're facing these very strong militaries that seem unassailable, and yet Erdogan has shown the way, hasn't he?
Yes, but one thing to say about the Turkish military, it's not that I was a fan at any point, but if you want to draw the comparison with other countries in Muslim majority societies, the military was involved in running the state after the coups, but it always retreated and was happy to hand back power to civilian politicians, elected politicians. There was no extended military period, which sets Turkey apart from bulk of the global south. I mean, think about Brazil, for instance, or even Greece, where the military ran the show for 7 years. That was unheard of in Turkey. So they did allow space, even in the old days, to people like Erdogan, so long as they didn't overstep certain red lines. That was the twist in the story. And the AKP initially managed to push those lines. And when there was a frontal clash towards 2007-2008, when there was a test of wills, Erdogan managed to win the race, and the military was marginalized. But yeah, I mean, I'm sure that serves as an inspiration to many people around. Certainly during the Arab Spring, when lots of folks out there were very hopeful about Egypt. But Turkey is unique in many respects, and it's hard to replicate its experience elsewhere, I find. That was probably one of the lessons learned from this Arab awakening.
Okay, let's deal with some specific issues that Erdogan has grappled with. And, you know, we've touched on this a bit, but just to get a clear readout on his attitudes to Western Europe and the European Union. So he started off wanting to be championing Turkish membership of the EU. Did that reflect a personal attachment, quite common at the time, looking up to the West, looking towards probably wanting to travel to the West to be part of Western culture?
I think so, yeah. The thing is that even amongst Turkish conservatives, the West has always played a role, just because of life, really. I mean, it's if you look at all those places like Germany, Austria, France, Belgium, and so on and so forth, they tend to come from, again, in Anatolia, sometimes the east, because of the impact of the Kurdish conflict. So those Euro-Turks, the backbone, the relationship, the social level, very often the same people who'd vote AKP, these are not the so-called white Turks of Western metropolises. And therefore, you could say that, yeah, Erdogan needed the West because it was an ally in those days when he had to fight for his survival against the military and the rest. So it was a marriage of convenience. But I think it also reflects a sociological reality that Turkey, and by Turkey I mean across the board, has a very dense linkage to the West, which goes through the economy and through society. Despite everything, the reorientation of Turkish foreign policy, trade, and so on and so forth, Turkey continues to trade and depend on investment from the West. So anybody running the show in Ankara, irrespective of the political orientation they have, will have to keep an eye on the West and Western Europe and the EU first and foremost, invest into this relationship. And I think that's the state we are in with Erdogan. His anti-Western rhetoric, never mind that rhetoric. He knows that Turkish interests connect the country and society to those places. And that was very much true also in the early days. So it's more than just tactical. It reflects this deeper interdependence that is in existence and it's easy to see in Turkey.
Yeah, it's one of the interesting things in your book that although all this rhetoric is there, it is more nuanced than that, and that he still does reach out in quite real ways to the West and keeps links that he might, if you went by the rhetoric, think he was going to abandon. But how important to his psyche and to his political development was a sense of rejection by the West? Because, you know, there are many in the European Union who simply do not want Turkey in, possibly on religious grounds, on cultural grounds, whatever. And that must hurt many Turks, including Erdogan.
It's central, yes, but he's nothing exceptional. It's not about him, it's about pretty much anyone in Turkey, including those people who hate Erdogan's guts, to put it diplomatically. I mean, the seculars felt double rejected because to them, they actually carried the flag of Westernization. But even in those days, Turkey was not embraced, was given the cold shoulder. And then you have an Islamist who early in his career slammed the West, and Erdogan was given credits and got all the support and love from Western governments. So there is a demographic in Turkey which is totally out there, Erdogan, but they have pretty much the same resentment against the West. So it's pretty universal. And the thing about Erdogan is that he realized that he could actually harness this sentiment. Because Turkish nationalism is a pretty potent force. I mean, it works across the board. It mobilizes passions. It motivates people. So at the moment that it turned out that Turkey is not welcome and sort of membership aspiration is a dead end street, and that was, to be clear, around 2007, certainly when Nicolas Sarkozy became the president of France, Erdogan started to more and more exploit nationalism and anti-Western resentments. And that escalated after 2013 and the Gezi Park protests, where actually he adopted a rhetoric common with the regime in the Kremlin that the West is not just rejecting Turkey, but actually actively plotting to subvert the government, the legitimate government. And then you had the coup attempt. So it went into stages, and part of it is just the generic identity orientation of anybody in Turkey, this love-hate relationship with the West. Part of it is Erdogan's personal disappointment, but also there's a strong element of pragmatic electioneering. Given the new set of circumstances, it became just politically more profitable to be at least rhetorically, if not in substance behind closed doors to be anti-Western and to exploit that. And maybe also in 2016, there is an element of sincerity because Erdogan and his closest circle do believe, but that's not about the EU, it's about the US. They do believe that the US was involved or at least turn a blind eye to the conspiracy.
Yeah, this is the coup. We'll get onto that too, but I just wanted to deal with some other of these sort of big issues in Turkish politics. So there's the EU and then there's the Kurds. Now then, again, there's been a significant development in his view on that, hasn't there? Can you talk us through that and explain why his ideas have changed?
Now his attitude to the Kurdish issue evolved over time. Ideologically, you could well argue that Islamists were much more relaxed vis-a-vis the political demands of the Kurds, because so long as the Kurds belong to the same umbrella, and that is Islam, it's part of the country where piety is at its peak, you could actually co-opt Kurdish nationalism and redefine Turkish nationalism in a more inclusive way, whereas Islam rather than ethnicity plays a more central role. So that's on the ideological level. On the more pragmatic level, Erdogan was hoping for Kurdish votes in the neck-to-neck contests. And sometimes that was tricky because the Kurds started establishing their own parties and they were competing or staying neutral when the AKP was fighting for its survival. But at the same time, for many Islamists, they could see the Kurds, the Kurdish nationalists of the left, as fellow victims of the heavy-handed state. But that was the first stage. The second stage was when Erdogan actually saw the prospect. And that's actually sort of a depressing story. He saw the prospect once he was in power of striking a deal with the PKK, so the armed wing of the Kurdish National Movement, which would pacify Turkey. It would be some sort of a Good Friday Agreement, will secure his long-term survival in power because the Kurds will, if not vote for AKP, and they'll be in coalition, they'll be sharing power with him, and also strengthen Turkey's hand in the region, because once you solve your internal problem, then you could actually go out in places like Iraq, also Syria, and Iran, and engage. So Turkey would be a model how you resolve those issues. So that was the high point. He had two attempts at peace process, one in 2008, 2009, and a more serious one in 2013. Unfortunately, this opportunity was squandered, and it's a long conversation. Who is to blame? Was it Erdogan feeling threatened by the Kurdish movement and their reluctance to play to his agenda of establishing a one-man show in Ankara? Or was it the PKK overplaying its hand and starting a guerrilla warfare in 2015, in especially in urban areas? But either way, basically right now we are back to square one, despite all the hope 10 years ago, 15 years ago, where actually Turkey is decidedly into suppressing the PKK, defeating it, hunting it down, whether it's in the southeast or in northern Iraq, recurrent operation, and indeed in Syria as well. But the fact of the matter, and that was very clear as early as the 1990s when the Turkish forces managed to capture the founder of the PKK, Abdullah Öcalan, the fact of the matter is that this is a war neither party can win. So there is no way the PKK can be eradicated. But they're not in a position to capture any significant territory in Turkey. And in fact, there is no prospect, because many Kurds these days live outside their native region there in Western Turkey. So we have a long-term stalemate. But it'll take another generation before politicians on all sides realize that they need to talk and come up with a solution.
Now, you've mentioned a couple of issues that, you know, there's been a clear development of his views on the EU and on the Kurds. What about the, you know, one of those questions that is always there in Turkish politics, attitudes to the Armenian genocide? What has his view on that been?
Well, he never, to me, never had a clear view. Early in those good days when Turkey was open to the European Union, there was a major breakthrough because all of a sudden there was no taboo anymore. A landmark conference took place in 2005 when the G word was openly mentioned. Then you had years and years where 24th of April, the Genocide Day, was commemorated openly by leftists, liberals, and activists. So the AKP period opened the debate, the discussion about what had happened and its implications into the present. And Erdogan was not a fan. I think he was afraid of this problem because it was a red rag that could mobilize his nationalist opponents, that AKP is sort of giving, quote-unquote, Turkish enemies a platform. So he was afraid this could get out of hand, but at the same time, he was not pushing back in any ways. Unfortunately, that's all history now. The nationalist turn in Turkey, which sort of first led to the suppression of the liberals, then the collapse of the Kurdish peace process has also taken toll on the debate about the genocide. Now, the coalition between the AKP and the Nationalist Action Party has basically precluded any debates about historical responsibility, about reparation and so on. And despite the fact that actually you do have an accommodation discourse sometimes from higher up in Ankara, in the sense that the genocide is an agenda pushed by the diaspora, but there is the Armenian community in Turkey, which of course has benefited under the AKP, including property being restored. So all those loyal citizens of Armenian descent have a place in Turkey and their rights are protected.
I was just wondering if we can go back to 2016, which you mentioned before, and that coup attempt. And that revolves around the relationship with Fethullah Gulen. Can you just talk us through who Gulen is, and what Erdogan's relationship with him was and is now in the light of that coup?
Well, it's a big, big discussion because Gulen was one of those religious leaders who built a powerful movement uniting supporters, media, businesses, and managed to actually infiltrate state institutions at many levels. And that was a project that went through various stages, starting from the 1960s. So for the AKP, Gulen was initially a fellow traveler, somebody who shared their religious outlook, who was also friendly towards the West, it must be mentioned, in that respect, different from Erbakan, but also somebody who could be useful as an ally because he had the commanding heights. He had the media empire. He could sort of get the narrative about Islam being compatible with the West. And he had people in the state machine. So that was a natural coupling of the two strands in the Islamist movements. Now, the more interesting question is, why is it that those two fell out? And there was a moment where actually the influence of Gulen was so strong. He was critical, for instance, for winning the 2010 referendum, when he did mobilize a lot of support. But I think ultimately it's the same boring story about leadership and who is being the top dog in the movement. Erdogan felt threatened by the Gulenists and not just not Erdogan, other people in the AKP probably as well, and their rising influence, which was there behind closed door. So this whole talk about a parallel state,
despite being instrumentalized by Erdogan, was not without substance. I think around 2010, soon after the referendum, the cracks were already there. Gulen didn't approve of the Turkish turn against Israel. Later on, Gulen has leaked recordings of Turkish officials negotiating with the PKK. There was the veiled criticism here and there. And certainly after the Gezi Park protests, the Gulenists went full frontal against Erdogan. So Erdogan felt that he had helped build a monster and was personally felt threatened by the Gulenists. And he brought the fight into the open, even though it was the Gulenists who started this anti-corruption investigation in December 2013. So yeah, it's long story short, I think it's about power. It's not about ideological differences, about different outlooks or attitudes. But the struggle has taken toll on Turkey. So the ultimate victims are the ranks, rank and file Turks, because first of all, the coup, once you start this gamble, there is no positive ending. If the Gulenists and their allies, and by the way, there's a lot of unknown about the mechanics and what happened and how it happened and who's in the driving seat, but it's safe to assume this was the Gulenists playing critical role there. But once you choose to use military violence against a legitimate government, then you basically are setting Turkey on the path of a civil war. And that's something on a mini scale happened that fateful night. But as we saw, the alternative was not much better either, because, or maybe it was better, it was the lesser evil, but it brought in its wake huge costs, because Erdogan threatened, he was probably fighting for his physical survival that night of the 15th of July. He turned out very vindictive and he inflicted the repressions on pretty much anyone who happened to be against Erdogan, including the leader of the Kurdish party selecting Demirtas, has de-democratized Turkey. I mean, it put Turkey on this authoritarian trajectory.
Yeah, I always thought the Western commentators were unsympathetic to that. I mean, he could have been killed that night. And so that's bound to affect his judgment, right? I mean, it would with anyone.
Yes. That's true, although it's very clear that the repression spread out to people who had no connection whatsoever to the coup, and selecting Demirtas would be a good example. Or people who spoke out against the coup and had no love lost for Gulen. But you're absolutely right. I mean, that was a critical moment for Erdogan when, I mean, he was fighting for his survival. I mean, he did go to prison after the 1997 bloodless coup. He was facing threat of party closure in 2008, but it's nothing compared to actually facing a commando team sent to basically queue on the spot or maybe capture you. And so for him, it was a turning point.
Bound to have been a turning point, yes. Okay, so now then, let's just broaden it out. I'm going to ask you some questions about the future, but one issue I'd like you to encapsulate is, you know, what's more important to Erdogan now? Is it his nationalism or his Islamism? I mean, maybe they come together with Ottoman rhetoric. I mean, it's also worth saying that he doesn't seem to extend much Muslim solidarity to the Uyghurs for, you know, purely pragmatic reasons, like many other Muslim leaders. So when you put all that in the mix, how does he weigh up Islamism and nationalism?
I don't think he sees a choice between the two. He thinks those two can work together in sync. And to be honest, the experience of the past 6-7 years demonstrates that's the case. The sort of conservative tinged Turkish nationalist ideology he represents is internally coherent, and it plays with a sufficient number of voters. I think his basic motivation is not ideological, it's political. It's about him clinging to power no matter what. And that's become more difficult with time for two reasons. One reason is that the opposition has gotten its act together. It's mounting a very serious challenge, and the economy is tanking. I mean, looking at inflation in Turkey and the cost of living crisis. That's not reason number one. The second reason is that in a system like the one Erdogan has built, there is no exit option. It's difficult to step down from power. It's the bicycle theory, as it were. You can either go to exile, because if you lose the elections, the opposition probably will be after you, scapegoat you. And many people in your ranks might defect as well, that once you become a liability. So exile or prison. And it's not just about you, it's your family, all the business clients you've cultivated over the years. So the stake is very high for him. And therefore, his priority at this stage, I think, is just to survive in power and to keep going.
You think he'll die in office, do you?
That's the case. But if he retires and passes the baton to somebody else, that's ridden with risks as well, not least because there is no obvious successor. He has tried several successors to prime them, but they have turned out to not be good enough, not to be credible. And there's nobody else to be seen. And in a system which is so personalistic, where Erdogan is a towering figure and takes all the decisions, and where you fit in the hierarchy is very much dependent on the sort of relationship we have with the leader. Once you exit, be it for health reasons or just you're not able to perform the job anymore, there's a huge gap. So the future of Turkey post-Erdogan, at least for some time, might be very bleak, because there'll be chaos in the aftermath of his departure, I'm afraid.
Well, political chaos, but I'm also just finally interested in where Turkey might head in terms of ideological issues, because here is this Islamist leader who is tapping into clearly deep wells of public support, and yet I think the polls show that Turkey is becoming quite clearly more secular. So there is a contradiction there, isn't there?
Yes, I mean, that's a very good observation, that if there was ever a project to change society fundamentally in terms of lifestyle and outlook, it's not working. And what has worked is making society more accepting to conservatism and religion, bringing religion into the mainstream through various means, through making piety acceptable, bringing religious education into the fold. But also, I must say that the main opposition parties, including the Kemalist Republican People's Party, are much more open to Islam. That's why Ekrem İmamoğlu won the race in Istanbul, because he embraced piety. So that's one side of it. But the other side of it is, again, that there is no next generation which prays five times a day and conforms with all the precepts of Islam and has this Islamist outlook on life. So it's really complicated, and you have those two trends living side by side. And it also speaks to the strength and the resilience of Turkish society and politics, that despite turmoil, polarization, authoritarianism, violence, their ways of synthesizing, of accommodating. It's also reflected in the fact that you have an opposition against Erdogan, and that's a function of just having this towering figure that bridges differences to do with lifestyle and secularism, Islamism divide. You have Islamist parties, but also you have the secularists inside. And then also, you arguably have Turkish nationalists and the Kurds, albeit as a hidden partner in this coalition. So the fact that you could cooperate across those deep cleavages speaks volumes about the kind of country Turkey is, despite all the predicaments it had to deal with.
Well, he's a fascinating figure, and you've really helped us understand him. So thanks very much indeed.
Thank you.